Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of how much the shutdown and the impending default is being orchestrated by an evangelical cabal whose apocalyptic vision of Armageddon is compatible with bringing the house down and purging evil in order to purify and be reborn. Li Fong, a reporting fellow with the investigative fund at The Nation, joins us. He has an article at The Nation, Meet the Evangelical Cabal Orchestrating the Shutdown. Then we will speak with John Storr, the managing editor of The Washington Spectator, where he has an article, Obama Must Call the Right's Bluff. We will examine whether instead of calling the speaker's bluff on the government shutdown, Obama should be calling Boehner's bluff on the debt ceiling and, as John Storr argues, if Obama wants to break the fever of an extreme reactionary GOP, he should make an example of Boehner by crushing him following Machiavelli's advice, if you do a person minor damage, they will get revenge, but if you cripple them, there is nothing they can do. Then finally, we will speak with award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal about his latest book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, and examine how much Israel has moved and is moving to the right, as well as discuss Max's earlier book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, which is certainly topical as the Tea Party is not only shattering the Republican Party, but are now shattering the country. Joining us now is Li Fong, who is a reporting fellow with the investigative fund at the Nation Institute. He covers money in politics, conservative movements, and lobbying, and his work has resulted in multiple calls for hearings in Congress and the Federal Election Commission. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and his latest article at the Nation is Meet the Evangelical Cabal Orchestrating the Shutdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, Li Fong.
Ian, thank you so much for having me.
And tell me it's not true that the entire government is being shut down by a small cabal of Christians who meet at the Ebenezer Coffee House next to Union Station and plot to destroy the government over their fair trade coffee and the Christian books that are available there for customers.
Well, this organizing effort that goes on in the basement of this coffee house represents a larger network. Right, so there are leaders of various Christian right and conservative nonprofits and organizations. They come together every Wednesday to plot various policy and political strategies. And what's interesting, and what was reported on Monday in the New York Times by really some fantastic investigative work, was that this group and another affiliated group has been working since February to plan the strategy, to create a resolution, to push lawmakers to attach defunding Obamacare to the continuing resolution. So this is many months in the making, and through advocacy, through meetings, through advertisements, and Tea Party rallies that happened throughout the summer, they made it happen.
So the umbrella of that group is the Conservative Action Project?
Well, the Conservative Action Project is the name of this ad hoc coalition. The Conservative Action Project, though, is funded by this evangelical organization, this Christian right organization called the Council for National Policy, and it's their members who meet every Wednesday morning and again for lunch at this coffee house.
But one of the members of the Council on National Policy since 2008, his name is Patrick Pezzella. He was nominated by President Obama to be a member of the Federal Labor Relations Authority, which acts as a miniature National Labor Relations Board for federal workers, a lot of whom, I might add, are now being furloughed. So explain that connection.
Well, it's actually quite surprising and a little bit mystifying. The FLRA acts, as you mentioned, like the NLRB. They help arbitrate disputes between federal workers and various labor unions. So they're there basically as an oversight body to make sure there's some type of, you know, dispute resolution. And it's actually quite surprising because Patrick Pezzella, this Republican operative, he's been traveling in these circles for very long. He's the highest paid operative of the Conservative Action Project. He's helped manage these efforts to attack Democrats, to mobilize opposition to Obama's judicial nominees. And for some reason, President Obama nominated him to this federal employee board in August. I've sent out some emails, but I still don't have any really concrete reason why he was nominated. That's still kind of a big question mark.
Well, he's certainly not doing Obama any favors at the moment. So give us a sense then, Li Fong, whether or not there is a connection between this apocalyptic end times mentality that is prevalent on the religious right. In fact, it's maybe their most zealous organizing principle. And, of course, there have been huge bestsellers about the end of time, and that all of these preachers like the Reverend Hagee, that's what they rail about all the time. And a byproduct of this mentality has been this Christian Zionist movement, where there's close ties between the Israeli right and the American Christian right in terms of trying to precipitate Armageddon so that all of sinners like you and me end up in a lake of fire. And, you know, our world ends in burning flesh in order for their world to begin, which, frankly, is the height of hubris. But that aside, is there a connection in the mentality of bringing the house down, of destroying the economy in order to get your way, and the idea that the world has to end before the purified can take over?
Well, probably the biggest and most well-known ambassador from this movement, Tim LaHaye, evangelicus, he's written several books. The famous of them have been the Left Behind series that talks about the end times, the rapture, and how it's just around the corner. He was the founder, among several others, including Hagee, but he was the founder of the Council for National Policy, which again sponsors the Conservative Action Project that's been organizing and planning this government shutdown. You know, I was actually at the Weyrich lunch today at Ebenezer's Coffee House trying to get to the bottom of this. I spoke to several folks there. By the way, there were conservative reporters at that meeting, folks from the conservative magazine Human Events. Congressman James Lankford was attending the meeting today, and several Christian right activists and radio show hosts were there as well. I talked to someone from the American Family Association, the organization best well-known or best affiliated, I suppose, with Brian Fisher. This was another host. And, you know, I talked to her a little bit about this end times idea. She was a little bit cagey. She wasn't very enthusiastic about talking about that angle. But she made it very clear it's not just the continuing resolution and Obamacare shutting down the government over that. She'd like to push this fight into the debt ceiling, which really would cause incredible economic damage and the type of chaos that is, I suppose, sort of apocalyptic.
Again, I'm speaking with Li Fong, who's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. He covers money and politics, conservative movements and lobbying, and his work has resulted in multiple calls for hearings in Congress and the Federal Elections Commission. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and his latest article at The Nation is Meet the Evangelical Cabal Orchestrating the Shutdown. So one of the things that I find disturbing here is, Li, is that the main poster boy for this shutdown and the likely move towards default, I mean, we don't know for sure whether we're going to default on October 17. I mean, obviously, one has to take into account that in negotiations, you don't fold until the last minute. So that's likely that it will go on till that point. And whether Boehner has a come-to-Jesus moment or not, I don't know. My understanding is that the cabal that's shutting down the government and threatening to tank the economy is down to about 35 of these Tea Party Republicans. It's pretty extraordinary. Well, 35 plus one, if you got to put Boehner in there. But we know that the guy behind so much of this and who's rallied the House to take this suicidal path is U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. His father, Rafael Cruz, is a rabid right-wing Christian preacher and the director of the Purifying Fire International Ministry. And his Christian ideology is rooted in this radical Christian ideology known as Dominionism or Christian Reconstruction, which calls for an anointed Christian leader to take over, or leaders to take over the state and make the goals and laws of the nation biblical. And it wants to reduce government to organizing little more than defense, internal security, and the protection of property rights. And it's an attempt to fuse Christian religion with the iconography and language of American imperialism and nationalism, along with the cruelest aspects of corporate capitalism. So that's Ted Cruz's father. What do we know about Ted Cruz?
Well, Ted Cruz certainly has been very closely connected with this religious group, the Council for National Policy. He's reportedly spoken at their events. If you look at the big New York Times story on Monday, it's obvious to any observer that Cruz has been leading the push. But if you look at the New York Times story from a few days ago, you know, he had been working hand in glove with this coalition all throughout the year to push this. And they provided the financial support necessary to make this possible. So to give you an example, over the summer, to lay the groundwork for what's happening today, Heritage Action and several conservative advocacy groups sponsored a town hall series demanding that the defunding of Obamacare be connected to the federal budget. As some senators kind of spoke out against Cruz early on, they were kind of silenced through paid advocacy. So when Senator Graham and other folks said this might not be a good idea, Heritage Action struck back very quickly, paying for radio advertisements, putting out statements. So they were quick to corral folks behind Cruz. And this is and many of these folks involved in the Conservative Action Project, most of them religious, although not all, have large listservs. They've got big networks. Many of them are radio show hosts. So where you have some of the groups like Heritage Action doing this kind of hammer approach of attacking Republicans who wouldn't play ball and promoting Cruz, at the same time you have these other organizations that are whipping up their members, preparing them for this fight, asking for them to call into Congress, asking for them to show up at these rallies and town hall events. Some of them are very well attended, with over 2,000 people in Texas. So Cruz has been really the crucial element here. He might actually speak at it's been rumored that he's speaking at a big strategy session on how to move forward on the debt ceiling and funding the government tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. So he's really been the central figure here. The question, though, of how his father figures into this and his father's view of Christianity, of the Dominionist movement, you know, I couldn't speak to that, but I think there are absolute parallels between what his father preaches and what the Council for National Policy has espoused for 30 years. I mean, it's a lot of the same views, the same type of, same form of Christianity that you were just speaking about.
So this kind of absolutism, is that the backbone behind these Tea Party extremists who are prepared to go to the mat? They've now shut the government down, and they're also prepared to tank the economy. And a number of fairly prominent Republicans have started to even suggest that a default on the debt wouldn't be such a big deal. So I'm trying to get an understanding, because I understand the libertarian streak in the Tea Party ideology. Not that I think perhaps even using the word ideology is too kind. The movement did start out as a reaction against the TARP funding the bailout, but it's quickly been captured by a handful of oligarchs and become a astroturf movement of the Koch brothers. So I'm not sure where their ideology is. We certainly know where the money's coming from, but just to giving them the benefit of the doubt that some of them are influenced by libertarianism, which clearly motivates Rand Paul. Can you give us some kind of diagnosis here on the religious component along with the libertarian component?
Well, look, I think you're right to say, or at least be skeptical of using the term ideology, because that connotes some type of consistency. Remember, it was the Heritage Foundation 20 years ago that invented the individual mandate. It was the Heritage Foundation that helped Governor Romney develop his plan in Massachusetts that has, you know, state-based exchange, the individual mandate, penalties for employers, subsidies for low-income folks to pay for their own policies on the exchange. It's really identical to health reform, and now we have them going 180 degrees, saying that they won't tolerate any funding of the government that doesn't shut down a health care plan that is really identical to something that they've supported for two decades. So there isn't an a consistent ideology here. What might be guiding some of this is faith, that you know this idea that government is sinful and that everything has to be destroyed and remade with this kind of very radical vision. If you listen to some of the radio shows, associated with the Conservative Action Project, American Family Association being one of them, these are certainly their ideas, and they don't hide them. The fact, though, that they've been able to translate these ideas into such political muscle has been kind of extraordinary if you look at what's going on right now on Capitol Hill.
So what's your sense, then, of whether or not... I mean, one of the great ironies, Li Feng, was the whole House, after that lockdown where they were all taken into a safe room because of this mentally disturbed woman that was shot. And shortly thereafter, the House met on a bipartisan basis, congratulated the Capitol Hill police for essentially, you know, protecting them. And then they turn around and, of course, the same people that protected them are the ones that they're furloughing. So there's an enormous disconnect, obviously, here. Is there a chance, if rationality doesn't work and rational arguments from economists and even from Wall Street people don't have any traction, could some religious figures step forth and talk about the prophet Jesus and how much he cared about the poor and the downtrodden? And would that work, do you think?
Frankly, I don't think that would work at all. What these lawmakers understand is just the sheer politics of re-election. I think the big variable coming up is the business community, right? In the last couple of years, the big business community, as represented by the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Business Roundtable, what have you, they've been very partisan, far more partisan than they've been in the last century, airing ads and doing advocacy almost purely against Democrats, only against the type of initiatives that President Obama has sponsored, with exception to some of the entitlement stuff. But what they haven't done is aired campaign ads or gone into the districts of congressional Republicans to pressure them in the ways that they usually pressure Democrats. Now, with the debt ceiling approaching and growing anger over this government shutdown, the question is, will the business community flex its muscle and politically pressure these lawmakers? Remember, it was in 2010 that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce raised a $75 million advocacy campaign, spent at least $35 million in direct campaign ads, went into people's districts, hired dozens of organizers, aired millions of dollars worth of issue ads, and created the Tea Party Caucus on the Hill by utilizing Citizens United to spend all this campaign money. The question is, now that the Tea Party is threatening to force the country into default, will the chamber use its funds? And remember, this is an organization that has around a $200 million annual budget that has connections to all the largest corporations in America. Will they go into these districts, into these Tea Party districts, start airing advertisements, start pushing them the way that they know how to? Right now, the chamber has only made some angry phone calls, reportedly. Earlier this week, they put out a letter to Capitol Hill. But lawmakers respond most to election advocacy because, again, all of the House is being reelected next year. They're all facing reelection. And even if some of these folks are in safe districts, they can never be defeated. Negative ads promote primary challenges, right? So the sooner the business community steps up and attacks these Republicans, the sooner that they will understand that there are consequences to their actions.
Well, Li Feng, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Li Feng, who is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. He covers money and politics, conservative movements and lobbying, and his work has resulted in multiple calls for hearings in Congress and the Federal Election Commission. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and his latest article at the Nation is Meet the Evangelical Cabal Orchestrating the Shutdown. We're going to take a brief station break and talk about how Obama must call the right's bluff.
Burning Isaac, Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his conversation. Do you believe in a second chance? Do you believe in rapture?
Every crack, anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other, like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this Cosmo Ball.
And joining us now is John Storr, the managing editor of The Washington Spectator and a professor of writing at Yale University. His essays and journalism have appeared in Al Jazeera English, The New Statesman, The American Prospect, Columbia Journalism Review, Dissent, Reuters, and The UK Guardian. His latest article at The Washington Spectator is Obama Must Call the Right's Bluff. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Storr.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And expand on the idea that instead of the Obama calling the speaker's bluff on the government shutdown, he should be calling Boehner's bluff on the debt ceiling.
Right. There's kind of two bluffs right now, and you could call it Boehner's double bluff if you will. The first one is where he says that I don't have the votes in the House to reopen the government, and most of the attention has been paid to that statement, and most of the attention is coming because Obama has been saying prove it, and that's exactly what Obama should be doing. But the other bluff is that Boehner won't budge on the debt ceiling unless there's concessions on Obamacare and other forms of federal spending. And there's reason to think that Boehner won't go that far. In my piece, I point out that during his interview with ABC's This Week, George Stephanopoulos, he actually says on the side that at first he wanted this showdown to be about the debt ceiling, not about the government shutdown and not about Obamacare. And the reason, I think, is that he really wanted to run up against something that he couldn't control, and he could tell to his conference, the Tea Party faction, that, hey, this is out of my hands. We did it the best we could, and now we just have to pass this thing. And he would turn to the Democrats and say, okay, let's pass this thing. But he can now, because there was such a push by Ted Cruz over the summer and Jim DeMint's Heritage Foundation and everything, they would not let go of the implementation of Obamacare. And so he had to do it now, and so we probably won't see any budge, at least from Boehner, until October 17th, and then we'll see what happens.
But isn't that normal tactics in negotiating, that you negotiate up to the deadline and that's when you yield?
Yeah, I think so. The threat now is that that he won't yield, and so it's still a guessing game. And in fact, what complicates things even more is that, according to today's New York Times, there's a growing chorus of Republicans who are saying the debt ceiling is no big deal, and of course that flies in the face of conventional wisdom among economists and business people, like your previous guest Li Fang was talking about. The business community getting involved, they are really concerned about the debt ceiling, and it'll be anyone's guess how they respond in the next few days.
But in your article at the Washington Spectator, John Storr, Obama Must Call the Right Bluff, we're talking about, you mentioned here in your article that it's the strategy of the Ted Cruzes and the Mike Lees to unseat Democrats who are running in red states in 2014, and that they think that this is the right strategy. Now, ironically, to my mind, what is in fact happening here is that the best chance that the Democrats have of taking over the House in 2014, and this has been indicated by a recent public policy poll that says that the Democrats will take back the House and that the vulnerable seats that they will take are the very moderate Democrats – the very moderate Republicans that Obama is trying to call out now to say, you know, call the vote on the House floor, Boehner, because we know that there's enough moderate Republicans living in Pennsylvania, New York, like Peter King, and California that are not in red states that are feeling the pressure, and there's no Tea Party traction in their constituency. So they're the ones that are prepared to, man up and stop this insanity. But the price that they're going to pay is they're going to lose their seats. I see that as a massive irony.
Yeah, it is. They all must be looking at Boehner too. I mean, Boehner himself, you know, the ostensible leader of the House, he's facing three primary challengers already. There's already been announcements for three in his district in southwestern Ohio. So, you know, if their leader is under the gun, and Mitch McConnell, by the way, is also facing a primary from the left and the right, and in the Tea Party Nation, the advocacy group just revoked their endorsement of Mitch McConnell. So, you know, it's a downward vicious cycle for that small group of people. But, you know, they rally around each other and, you know, what they believe internally is what everybody should believe, and so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Again, I'm speaking with John Storr, the managing editor of the Washington Spectator and a professor of writing at Yale University. His essays and journalism have appeared in Al Jazeera English, The New Statesman, The American Prospect, Columbia Journalism Review, Dissent, Reuters, and The UK Guardian. His latest article at the Washington Spectator is Obama Must Call the Right's Bluff. Now, in the article you talk about, you quote Machiavelli in saying that if Obama wants to break the fever of this extremely radical, you call it radical. I like to use the word reactionary because radical is in many ways a noble term.
Right.
Tom Paine, the intellectual founder, if you will, of the American Revolution was a radical. So was Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
And they certainly weren't reactionaries like these Christian Dominionists and Tea Party libertarians who don't believe in government at all or believe in God's government. But in any case, you say that to break the fever of the extreme GOP, Obama should make an example of Boehner by crushing him, following Machiavelli's advice: if you do a person minor damage, they will get revenge. But
right.
If you cripple them, there is nothing they can do.
Yeah, this is an interesting moment for the president. I mean, for those of us on the left, you know, who have been disappointed by him on various occasions, this is a moment where he could really show some strength. I mean, when your opponent is weak, and Boehner is weak, it's just generally understood to be this way. I mean, this is the moment where somebody in a position of strength like the president is needs to, you know, crush him and just do it. The question for those of us who have been, you know, disappointed by Obama in the past is, will he do it? Does he really have it in him? I don't really know, but in the past, I've thought that he really believes in the high and lofty principles that he expresses, and it's nice for a politician to express those lofty goals and everything, but, you know, when it push comes to shove, you want a person who can bring the hammer down on somebody when the timing is right. Now the timing is very right, and it has to happen because if we go up against that the debt default deadline, a lot of crazy things can happen. We already know what happened the last time we did this. The stock market went down, lots of insecurity with investors. And it paralyzed the recovery, and it didn't send us into a recession, but it slowed us way down more than we needed to. Our economy is already is not going getting better very quickly, but it's recovering, and we don't need this to happen again.
So, but if Obama were to crush Boehner, and after all, it's his own party that's doing him in, and the extent to which, he, you know, I mean, frankly, I don't have any sympathy for him because essentially, in order to keep his job, he's perfectly prepared to see hundreds of thousands of Americans lose their jobs. I mean, it's unconscionable. But he doesn't seem like a crazy guy like some of like Cruz does. Cruz is just a nasty piece of work. It's written all over him, and his shameful display in that faux filibuster, where he was clearly pandering to the Koch brothers and all these rich funders, at the same time using the Senate floor as a platform for his own personal fundraising and for his own personal ambition to run for president. So. He's thoroughly despicable, but Boehner seems basically like a good guy in a bad situation. So if Obama were to crush him, who would he get in his place? Would Eric Cantor? I mean, Cantor's a nasty piece of work.
And, you know, you probably get more of where this came from. I mean, nobody can read the future, obviously, but this president hasn't demonstrated real strength when it comes to bargaining with the Republicans. He's constantly let them push him. And the more that he's let them, the more that they have obviously pushed. We could all say, you know, that they're reactionary, that they're extremist, et cetera, but this president has allowed them to push and hasn't been pushing back. You know, we're deep enough now into his second term. The opportunity is right. We have this debt default crisis coming up. It could trigger an economic reaction. You know, the timing is right for this president to show real strength, and I hope he does.
And what do you think has restrained him when they have treated him with such contempt, such disrespect? It's been breathtaking over the years, what they've said to him and about him with impunity. What do you think restrains him? Because a lot of people think that he doesn't want to get tough and get angry because he doesn't want to fall in the trap of appearing to be the angry black man.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot of truth to that, I think. Two responses I would have. One is politics. He's very cagey and he's very calculating president, as a successful president is. So, you know, in 2011, he was thinking about the election, so, you know, he always wants to be the reasonable man in the room. Two, I think he believes he's the reasonable man in the room. This is what I mean by, you know, he expresses these lofty ideals, but I think he also really believes these lofty ideals, too. And so this is the part where I get very concerned, is that he may actually bring something to the table prior to the debt ceiling crisis and then strike a deal and only arouse this craziness even more. So this is why I suggest in the piece that he has to go right up to the end and make them blink. Yes, it probably will be the end of Boehner if he can make him blink. Yes, probably some other crazy person will come up to, you know, lead the House. But that person will be even more transparently crazy. So that will be a good thing, you know. And as you said earlier, the public policy poll showed that Democrats have a very good chance of taking the House. They're probably not going to lose the Senate in 2014, and so there will be an increasing isolation of this reactionary cabal, as they say.
And John Stoll, what do you think of Li Feng's suggestion that the Chamber of Commerce and others start putting out ads? Not that there's any indication they're going to do it, but I'm surprised by how complacent Wall Street has been. The president tried to sort of get them in on his side, and they really haven't weighed in very heavily. So I'm curious to know whether, I mean, you know, there is this thing called the shock doctrine that Naomi Klein wrote about, where we've seen many evidences of that, where catastrophes like Katrina end up being windfalls for private contractors. So is it possible that there are some on Wall Street that think crashing the economy is fine, and they're prepared to go along with it. It doesn't make sense economically, but I'm just asking you.
I don't want to, I guess at the risk of inspiring some conspiracy theory, I think they're waiting. I mean, they're waiting. They're going to be watching things very closely up until October 17th.
Mm. Well, they're saying that a lot of the top analysts are saying there's zero chance of it happening. They're basing that upon the fact that they're professionals and they're rational, and they don't think any rational person would do this. Mm. I don't think we're dealing with particularly rational players here on right. the Tea Party side.
Right. No, I don't think they are. I mean, these are people who believe that facts are a partisan expression. You know, to say that the sky is blue is a partisan expression, and it's only blue if I say it is blue. It's not blue if you say it's blue. So, but this is the kind of particular state of mind that is not easily understood among people who, you know, work on Wall Street and who are rational people and try to make rational decisions. It concerns me very much that you have a group of Republicans who are saying that the debt ceiling is no big deal. They can't possibly know that.
Let me ask you this, though, John. Uh-huh. Don't you think that these guys, like the North Carolina Republican senator and others that were featured in that New York Times yeah. article on Wednesday, saying that it's no big deal.
Right.
Are they getting calls from businessmen, you know, that give them money? They're saying you're out of your mind. What are you talking about? I mean, do you think that's happening?
Well, I mean, if you're a businessman, you're going to wait and see if you can, you know, capitalize on this somehow. And I mean, what you're suggesting is that there would be a reaction to that right away. I don't know if necessarily there would be. I think it would make a lot of sense, like you and me and other normal people would react that way. But we're not, you know, even these business people, these very powerful, check writers, they don't operate that way. They're going to see what kind of how they can cash out on some of these expressions. You know, maybe they can get Obama to blink. I mean, they're still waiting to see if that can happen.
Oh, I see. But what about
the past? In the past, yeah. He has blinked. So why wouldn't he do this time?
I see that. Yeah, your point's well taken. But I'm just thinking of the other point, which is that, you know, you can't short sell the United States. You're not going to make any money short selling the U.S. It's going to really be a catastrophe. And to that extent, I don't see how anybody in the business community could remain silent, notwithstanding that there may be some conspiracy theory vis-a-vis the shock, you know, the shock doctrine. But
well, keep in mind also that Obamacare really, you know, it's about health care, but it's also about labor.
Right.
You know, it liberates everybody who feels right. like they have to have their job to have health care. Mm-hmm. And that's very worrisome to people who want to control the labor market.
Right.
You know, so if you can get the president to blink on Obamacare,
right.
that's good for you. You know, so, you know, you do have a stake in waiting till the last minute to see right. what will happen.
Well, John, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate
it. Okay. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Storr, the managing editor of the Washington Spectator and a professor of writing at Yale University. His essays and journalism have appeared in Al Jazeera English, The New Statesman, The American Prospect, Columbia Journalism Review, Dissent, Reuters, and The UK Guardian. His latest article at the Washington Spectator is Obama Must Call the Right's Bluff. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel.
אני מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך. אני מפנה מקום בתי
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His new book just out is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And you have done a lot of sort of guerrilla journalism, if you will, gate-crashing right-wing events, getting the Reverend Hagee, the end-of-times guy, on the record and getting kicked out by his goons. You also were recently at Cooper's Unions, where Sheldon Adelson, along with this rabbi, and Elie Wiesel were hosting the mass murderer Paul Kagame on a program about Holocaust, you know, about honoring the Holocaust, and yet you had this mass murderer with the Holocaust survivor. That was pretty surreal. And what's his name? Sheldon Adelson said you should put duct tape over your mouth. So give us a sense then of, in terms of this activity, is there a thread here? Because my understanding is, and I'm looking into this as we speak, that more and more there's some evidence here that the Christian right and, you know, the Christian Zionists by extension are in many ways behind this shutdown. It's worth noting that the father of U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who is the real proponent of this shutdown, is a rabid right-wing Christian preacher who's the director of the Purifying Fire International Ministry, which is a Dominionist Christian Reconstruction movement. So let's start with that.
So are we talking about the bizarre panel I just witnessed, or the shutdown?
Well, the shutdown in the context that there seems to be a connection to the people that you've been trying to smoke out, the Hagees and those people, and the apologists of Paul Kagame, in the sense that there is growing evidence, and we had Li Feng on at the beginning of the program today with the Nation Institute, who's been writing about this. The New York Times had a piece about it a couple of days ago, is that the apocalyptic nature of the Christian right, in other words, bringing the temple down, the end of times, we all die in the lake of fire while they go up in the rapture, is a part of the psychology of shutting down the government and destroying the economy.
Yeah, well, let me go back to my first book, and then I'll bring it up to date. I'll try to bring it up to date with my second book and kind of use the Christian right and Christian Zionism as the thread that takes us there. You know, in my first book, it opens with a chapter about R.J. Rush Dooney, who is sort of the spiritual godfather of the Christian right, who conceived of the not only the tactics, but the vision of the kind of utopia that the Christian right wanted to get to, where the United States operated under biblical law, under all of the 614 laws of Leviticus, including that homosexuals should be stoned. And Rush Dooney and his acolytes were card-carrying libertarians. Their big issue was private Christian schools. And when the government tried to regulate these private Christian schools and force them to pay taxes and to integrate, in other words, to allow little black boys to go to school with little white boys, they revolted. And that's what really brought the Christian right, the evangelical wing of the Christian right, into this anti-abortion movement that they had, you know, that was previously all Catholic. And so they've used consistently issues like abortion, issues mainly abortion, to incite anti-government fervor. And it's the public funding of abortion and the funding of Planned Parenthood that they use as leverage to mobilize their followers into the Republican tent, into the Republican fray, in an alliance with corporate libertarians, with people like the Koch brothers. And now we see the culmination of that alliance with the government shutdown, where all these sides are getting what they want. And so you mentioned, this bizarre genocide panel I witnessed, where Paul Kagame was being celebrated by Elie Wiesel, who was probably paid tens of thousands to be there, and Shmuley Botia, this TV rabbi whose failed congressional campaign was funded by Sheldon Adelson And Adelson was there hailing Kagame as a military genius. And Adelson is really, a huge supporter of the government shutdown. He's one of the biggest backers of the Republican Party. He was the largest single funder of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. But he's also the biggest benefactor of Benjamin Netanyahu's entire political career. And he owns the largest newspaper in Israel, Israel Hayom, which is known by Israelis as the Bibiton, because all it does is promote Netanyahu and his agenda. And so to see Adelson funding Romney, we have to see that as really an act of Netanyahu trying to unseat the president of the United States. He failed, and now he's being punished with Barack Obama's historic phone call with Hassan Rouhani. Now, from a Christian Zionist perspective, that phone call signals another dispensation of the end times, that the United States is controlled by a peacemaker who, and as Christian Zionists have told me in interview after interview, the Antichrist will return as a peacemaker, on the phone with one of the leaders of Gog and Magog, acting against the state of Israel. So there's a lot of Christian Zionist opposition to Obama peaking right now over diplomacy around Iran. And Hagee and his people are doing all they can to milk this for political gain. And it all flows into the government shutdown in the United States.
But what about the psychology of it? You need to destroy everything in order to be born again. In other words, our lives have to end in burning flesh for their lives to begin. Is that the same with bring down the house, shut down the Congress, shut down the government, and bring down the economy?
I think that's part of the the mentality of a party that's been overtaken by this radical movement, which really sees the apocalypse as kind of an actual strategic goal. But I don't know if the Christian right is completely thinking about that. I think part of their agenda is defunding women's health services. I think first and foremost, that's what they're angling for. But in my book, Goliath, I write about a story that almost no Americans heard about, which highlights the growing alliance between the Christian right and the state of Israel, and the extent to which the tentacles of the Christian right extend into the heart of the Israeli government. There is a Bedouin village in the Negev desert called Al-Arakib, and it's one of the many Bedouin villages that the state of Israel seeks to demolish and whose residents it wants to evacuate and relocate so that they can build Jews-only towns for former soldiers and religious nationalists. This is inside the Green Line. I witnessed the third demolition of this village. It's been demolished 54 times because its residents keep building their structures back up. And on my way into the village, I saw a sign that said God TV Forest. And I said, what the hell is God TV? And I looked online and I realized that God TV was funding the planting of an artificial forest on top of the grounds of this Bedouin village and actually participating in this project of ethnic cleansing. And I found a video on their website by Rory Alec, this British televangelist, Christian Zionist, end-timer, saying that he was planting these trees there to prepare the land for the return of the Messiah. And he was working hand in glove with the Israeli government through the Jewish National Fund. Anyone who wants to plant a tree in Israel goes to the Jewish National Fund and donates there. They don't realize that these trees are being used in a campaign of dispossession, and that the Christian right is being brought into this campaign in a very direct way. And that's just one of many examples I point to of the Christians, of Christian Zionists, not just kind of politically supporting Israel from the U.S., but being directly engaged in human rights abuses on the ground.
Again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His new book just out is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. So in terms of your earlier book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, we're certainly coming we're coming to a crunch on that book, right? They're not just shattering the party, they're shattering the entire country. And your book just out, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, we're sort of dealing with some of the connections between the two. I have always been astounded, though, at the kind of this weird marriage of convenience between the Israeli right and the Christian right. Because after all, in order to bring about the rapture and the end of times, the state of Israel has to be destroyed. That's a prerequisite. And I think they only allow 144,000 Jews to go up from the Mount of Olives into heaven. So it's a pretty bad deal for the Israelis. And a lot of Israelis that I speak to sort of, you know, are rather sardonic about the whole thing. And my understanding is that what's behind this is that the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, have always pretty much controlled the Democratic Party and been able to get Israel's wish list passed whenever they want. But as an extra hedge, they've decided to get the right wing of the Republican Party on board. So that way they've got the entire Congress locked up. So is that the genesis of Christian Zionism?
It's definitely the direction, not just of Christian Zionism, but of the American Israel lobby that you're pointing to. I mean, the genesis was really Menachem Begin, the prime minister in 1980 from the Likud party, just as Likud had come into power, flying Jerry Falwell, then the leader of the Moral Majority, over on a private jet to Israel to see Jerusalem. And, you know, this alliance was born. I mean, and this is Jerry Falwell, who said that the Antichrist, if he returns, will be Jewish. And I think he said he'll have horns. So, yeah, of course, these are people who are operationally anti-Semitic in an alliance with people who are, you know, claiming to be representatives of the Jewish people. But Christian Zionists and Zionists share one thing in common, which is the view that there's no place for Jews in the world outside of Israel, and that Jews are an abnormal people who should not be accepted anywhere outside of Israel. It's two sides of the same anti-Semitic coin. But what I would say about what's happening now, I mean, we're witnessing a fascinating phenomenon right now in Jewish life in the United States. There is a new poll, a Pew poll, of Jewish attitudes that was commissioned by the Jewish Federations, the largest, you know, Jewish establishment national organization. And it had been suppressed for 2 years. The Jewish Federations was afraid to commission this poll because they were afraid of what it would reveal about young Jews in the U.S. And what it found was that secular young Jews, like me, only 16% of them believe that Israel is the promised land. In other words, that God gave this land to the Jews. Meanwhile, 82% of U.S. evangelicals believe this. So you have a clear base of unwavering, undivided support for Israel in the Bible Belt, whereas Jews are conflicted. Another poll of American rabbis, establishment American rabbis, shows that one-third of Reform and conservative American rabbis are afraid of voicing their true opinions about Israel and its policies in front of their congregations because they're afraid they'll lose their jobs. So even among the rabbis in the U.S., there's massive amounts of dissent. But among the evangelical community, the Tea Party, the Bible Belt, there is none. And so increasingly, we're not just seeing AIPAC turn to the Christian right for support. We're seeing the AIPAC becoming controlled by Republicans. Its leadership is increasingly being Republicanized. It's filled with neocons. There are almost no liberal staffers I can think of left there. Just look at M.J. Rosenberg's work for evidence of that, a former AIPAC staffer who rails against them constantly. And so that really leads to the creation of this organization, J Street, this liberal Zionist group in Washington, which is benefiting from the fact that Democrats are leaving the main pro-Israel groups behind, because they're turned off by their support for Benjamin Netanyahu and his warmongering and gloom and doom. They're turned off by Sheldon Adelson. They need somewhere to go, and J Street is the last resort. So I think this is a fascinating phenomenon that's going to really transform the special relationship in the long run.
Well, but you just said, Max Blumenthal, that young Jewish Americans like yourself and the millennials, and I did read that poll, and I read MJ's piece on it. And, you know, all of my Jewish friends continually say, you know, we're Americans. We don't like being afflicted with the burdens of Israel. And it does seem unfair that the automatic assumption is if you're Jewish, you therefore have to be either an apologist for or a proponent of Israel.
Right. It's unfair, and it is deeply damaging and even dangerous when Benjamin Netanyahu stands on public podium after public podium as the representative of the Jewish people, and he speaks on behalf of the Jewish people, this person who wasn't even elected by a majority of Israelis and has to coalition with this far-right Russian party, Israel Beiteinu, to hold power. And so he implicates all Jews in the world into the kind of human rights abuses that he and his army are committing in the occupied territories. I think a lot of Jews are deeply uncomfortable with that in the United States, and their dominant attitude isn't opposition to Israel or necessarily dissent, but one of apathy and kind of a repulsion where they don't really want to engage. Personally, I see absolutely nothing wrong with that. The problem is that there are programs like Birthright Israel that I went on, and I did a video on Birthright Israel, one of my guerrilla videos from their mega event recently, which was addressed by Benjamin Netanyahu, called Zayawana, because one of the participants described the experience, this 10-day free trip for Jews 18 to 25, as Zayawana. And they're encouraged to just kind of stay up all the time partying and seeing holy sites while they're being indoctrinated and partying with Israeli soldiers. Over 300,000 Jewish youth in the U.S. have been on this trip. That's a striking percentage of Jewish youth. And so there's a program of indoctrination across the board in Jewish life. Zionism still calls on young American Jews, and it won't let them go. And increasingly, we're hearing Jews say, let my people go. Just get this away from me and get it out of my life, because it's dangerous.
Well, Max, there's so much to talk about just in terms of your previous book, Republic and Gomorrah, and your current book, Goliath. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but let's revisit it soon, I hope.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republic and Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His new book just out is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.